music comes and speaks to a very deep place in people's souls, I guess. And so being next to somebody, especially when we're involved in the creative aspects of making music is...
Hey, what's up? This is Gabe from Legion Beats and MIDI Money, which is where we help music producers start, grow, and scale their music production businesses. Now, if you'd like to learn more about how I was able to turn Legion Beats into a profitable business and how you can join our community of hundreds of producers all working towards that same goal, head over to midimoney.com/go.
Right. So what's going on? We got Irko on the podcast today. I'm super excited. I went to go check out some of your credits so I could introduce you. Bro, this list is too long. I don't even know. It's crazy. But yeah, I just see Jay-Z, Pitbull, Mac Miller, Swiss Beatz, Snoop Dogg, Kanye West, Jennifer Lopez, goes on and on and on and on and on. Man, that's a very, very impressive list.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I've been around the block for a minute.
and that is as a mixing engineer, yeah?
Yeah. Most of my work right now is mixing. I want to say pre-COVID, it was probably maybe 80-20, 80 mixing, 20 recording. And now since COVID showed up in our lives, it's been 100% mixing, yes.
Nice. Yeah, it's so I, you know, now what I do is a lot of, you know, a lot of the marketing and business stuff around producing, you know, and selling beats and stuff. But for a long time, my main job was being an engineer and doing, you know, running a studio and doing a lot of recording and a lot of mixing as well. So I've got some of that background as well.
And I'm sure you learned a lot of lessons that were brought and over to the new business and applicable to these new landscapes, because of course people are people, and I see it every day. You know, my girlfriend, she's a lawyer, and the human interactions and exchanges, it doesn't really matter what subject we're talking about, what field we're in or whatever, it's always the same. It's always people, right? And communication and things like that. But there's definitely something to be said about the recording business, you know, being in a recording studio with artists and stuff like that, I guess makes your muscles work even more.
Yes. No, it is. There is something to it where, you know, I think for a lot of producers, because, you know, the audience for this show is mostly producers. Mm-hmm. Their experience is more like what my experience is now, which is mainly I'm by myself. You know, maybe I'm making beats. Maybe I'm working on the marketing stuff. Maybe I am mixing or whatever. But there is something about being in the room with the artist where you get a sense of both on the business side and the creative side of kind of understanding, you know, the psychology of this person who is really your customer, you know, or at least certainly the person that you're working with. So I definitely, I'm glad that I put in those years. And I'm also glad that I'm not currently in those years.
I resonate with what you just said 100%. I can totally live without the 5 a.m. sessions at 130 decibels, you know, totally fine with that. You know, I guess I'm too old for that.
Yes, I'm with you. Yeah.
But there's definitely truth to what you were saying about the exchange with the talent in the same room. Music comes and speaks to a very deep place in people's souls, I guess. And so being next to somebody, especially when we're involved in the creative aspects of making music is, you know, spending an hour or two or a day or two making a record with somebody or a band or a group or, you know, a talent, whatever, gets you to know this person at such a deeper level than if you were to, say, go on a cruise or something, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So, man, I feel like we should like back up a little bit, just so I'm sure people are hearing those credits and like, damn, well, how'd you do that? How'd you get there? So maybe could you give a little bit of the backstory of how you, you know, got to be in that position?
Sure. So this, right? A kid growing up in Venice, Italy, being obsessed with audio, with, you know, EQing the stereo or getting and mess around with the faders and the balance in a new car system or whatever the case. That was me, big time, growing up, as you know, far back as I remember, I was attracted to these things, even before liking music, which is a little bit backwards. Usually the audio world is discovered because of playing guitar, being in a band or DJing, whatever the case, right? For me, it was the other way around. And the audio led me to the discovery of hip hop music in the late 90s or mid 90s, I guess, because boom bap hip hop from New York was the genre that had the biggest audio content, the biggest kick drums, the biggest snare, it's called boom bap for a reason, right? And so that was really the magnet that attracted me to American music, first of all, music. And then eventually I discovered the whole hip hop culture and everything that was tied and represented in that expression of music. Obviously, at this point, I didn't really speak English that much. So, you know, anything that, I don't know, say Busta Rhymes would say to me sounded like ba 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 ba. I had no idea about anything, you know? So it was such a far thing for me geographically, culturally, and everything, you know? Of course, the passion of audio eventually led me to explore everything audio related, from, you know, putting 2 12-inch woofers in my car that was like slightly bigger than a smart car, you know, all of those things that you do when you're 20, and then DJing and producing. And eventually I started my little studio in the basement of my dad's garage, or I guess house in the basement. And luckily enough, there has been a bunch of lucky situations that kind of lined up for my career to grow. And the first one was, well, of course, that my family supported my endeavor in music. And by the way, nobody in my family is in music. So it was just like, oh yeah, that guy's doing that music thing, which is kind of weird. And then the second thing was that there is a very big Air Force base, American Air Force base, about 45 minutes away from where my dad lives. And so obviously the connections with Americans that were stationed there, most of the times young kids that wanted to do music, and after they had visited Florence and Rome and Venice once or twice or three times, it was like, all right, so what do we do next? And most of these people would be stationed out there for at least a year, maybe sometimes even more, you know? And so that's how I started making music and like exploring the culture and how to communicate with artists. And of course, my English was getting a little better. And that's how it kind of started. Did that for 5 6 years. Then the business just got too big for the basement. And I opened up a studio, which in typical Irko fashion, I go from 0 to 100. So I went from a little, you know, one car garage kind of situation that, you know, calling a studio would be, you know, a big praise, I guess. So I went from that to a standalone building with 6 live rooms, 2 control rooms. The biggest live room was 1600 square feet. It was huge. So I went literally from like this musty underground smelly place to like a standalone studio, which was fantastic. That took me about 2 years to fully equip. The studio existed already when I took over, so I didn't have to do any real estate activity, right? The place existed, the walls were there, everything, right? The AC, everything. But it took me 2 years to equip it, because at the time it wasn't plug-in and computer-based studios. It was all about, you know, the 1176s and the preamps and the EQs and the consoles and all that. And that stuff costed so much money. But I did that. And by the time I was fully in, I had 2 guys working there for me full-time. And I decided to go to New York, which is, it's a whole new story too that I can tell if we had an hour long just for that. But but basically I go to New York at, you know, 25 or something, with no money, no nothing. You know, I took one of those flights that was super cheap because I had to sleep in the airport and I slept on the bench. I did that, get to New York, and, you know, knowing 2 people, and I started planting little seeds here and there. And 3 weeks later, I fly back home to Italy with double platinum award for working with Jay-Z. And that was like, spoosh, you know, life changing moment. Welcome to America banner, you know, that.
Wow. How did that happen, though? Like, how are you able to get, you know, involved on that record?
At that point, I had mixed a number of records, maybe 2 3 albums worth of material for this producer, American producer, who was living in Tokyo at the time. And his main clients, our main clients, were Def Jam Japan, which was, as you can probably guess, boom bap hip hop with, you know, an American producer making, you know, true boom bap beats, but with Japanese rappers. He did that and he got tired. He goes to New York, and shortly after he moves back to New York, he gets a placement with 50 Cent, but G-Unit took over his track and didn't really have him have any say-so in the mix, which is very castrating for any producer, right? Or any artist, really. And he was like, well, you know, I've been working with Irko for so long. We got a thing going, and, you know, he's my guy. But of course, when you're dealing with big celebrities like that, at the time, 50 Cent was like the biggest artist on the planet, arguably. And so there was no way that they were going to just let a less known producer. It wasn't like a Dr. Dre, of course, right? So so basically from here on out, he was like, it doesn't matter who's going to get my tracks, who's going to get my beats, is also going to get the Irko mixed as a package. And that's what happened. Nice. The next thing that we were involved was the Kingdom Come, Jay-Z's album. And
wow. So it was the strength of that relationship with the producer that was so strong that once he was in that situation, you were in that situation.
That's been my mantra and my recipe for the little success that I had. It's been exactly that. Establishing a relationship with the producers. I kind of often say that I'm the producer's best friend. And that's truly what I believe in, what I strive to provide as a service, right? And it, basically half, maybe more than half of my business come from producers. And the other half usually come from, you know, managers, artists, anything else, right? But usually who really cares about the audio and the mixing is 9 times out of 10, the producers, not so much the artist, right?
Yeah.
So by establishing these marriages with producers that are household names, they always have clients, that's kind of how it happens. And then on top of that, it's the snowball effect of, you know, I kill one record. In that one record, there's never one person involved. There's always multiple people. And so the next time they need something, they will think about the bow tie for that mix, you know? So that's how it kind of, you know, spins and grows. So that's kind of how it happened. That's, you know, story of my last 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like it. It's funny. You do enough for these kind of interviews and you're like, okay, let me figure out how do I want to say this in the next, you know, 5 minutes or whatever. So no, that was good. Yeah, no, I think a few things in there. The whole the thing of developing those relationships in a way that even if you're you know developing those relationships with people that are maybe at whatever level they're at now, and then they come up, and therefore you come up together. I think that's yep. Huge. Yeah. And also,
you gotta grow with your peers.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. And I think sometimes we want to say, well, I want to be at the level, I want to work with this person who's at this level, this higher level, let's say, or, you know, farther along in their career. But a lot of times, one of the best ways to do that is to work with people who are maybe at your level or you know, somewhere parallel. And together you come up, one of you makes a step forward, and then you take that step forward together. I think that's, it takes a little bit of patience and it's being willing to put in that groundwork. But I think that's ends up creating that foundation where you can, like, you know, really, really have things take off.
Yeah. Yeah. And it makes sense. Think about Dua Lipa is probably not going to reach out for the guy that has never done anything to mix a record, right? It's most likely that the Dua Lipa from 2010, that still is not a big celebrity, is going to look around for somebody that helps to grow. So yeah, it makes total sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And also definitely resonated with me what you said about, you know, working for the producer. I know for me, when I was, you know, focusing more on producing, whenever somebody said, well, we want, you know, somebody else to mix it, I always got nervous because I knew me as the producer, you know, and I consider myself like producer engineer, in my experience, it was like 9 times out of 10, it was way worse. It sounded way worse, just at least partly because I, as a producer, spent so much time on each sound and I knew it inside out. And then, you know, you give it to somebody else, and if they're not, you know, an amazing engineer who cares and puts in the time to really do it right, they're going to make it, you know, they're going to make it worse, was my experience a lot of the times.
Totally. And that's where a lot of communication needs to happen. And a lot of my colleagues that are at a higher status, you got this buffer where you can't really talk to the person and things like that. I feel like that's so detrimental because it's all about communication. You know, some mixes require a completely new haircut, right? Some other ones, it's just a little trim. And so it depends on how much the producer is interested in getting the track or the feel or the vibe or the low end, whatever the case may be, enhanced or changed. Sometimes it's like, no change at all. We just wanted to be a little better. And it's like, okay, that 5% improvement is still huge for somebody that's been sitting with it for so long, or that has crafted that kick drum perfectly and so forth, you know?
Yeah. Is there anything for, okay, so like mostly producers who are listening to this, as far as, you know, they're tracking out their beats, whether if it's selling it directly to an artist or sending it out for a mix, is there anything where you're like, oh man, there's this, if they just did a little better job with this, it would help with the mix later? Anything to kind of keep in mind?
Oh yeah, that's like a huge thing. Absolutely. I always tell my clients to produce like there's no mix, record like there's no mix, mix like there's no master. So take all the decisions that can be taken at whatever stage we are at that stage, and don't just like pass it along to the next guy, right? So that will be a big, big one. For example, I get these tracks where there's like 150 tracks on the beats, right? And I'm like, all right, do we really need that 148th track? Like, is it really gonna make a difference, right? And so sometimes the answer is yes, of course, but sometimes it's just overproduction. So overproduction will be most definitely the first one if the end goal is to have a big sounding record, which I know is very counterintuitive, because you compare your track, say if it's just a beat, for example, you're having half of the dish that's completely missing, right? Because the vocals will eventually fill it up. But the vocals is not only an instrument just like the beat, but it's arguably the most important instrument, because that's what the people are going to sing. They're not going to sing the kick drum, right? Like, so they need to be able to hear that. And the vocal is such a crucial part of the landscape of audio, you know? So for example, a thing that helps a lot is to imagine that other parts are going to be there. So if you have one, say like chords, right? Like the chord is establishing the harmonic content of the track. Then you have one lead something, or maybe a guitar or something that sings on top of those chords, right? Now you have another melody that counterparts that one, that first one. Now we have two melodies plus the chords. Where are we going to put the vocal? So that's another melody part on top of that. So having that, future vision of what's going to happen to it helps a lot. And I know that the standpoint of comparing your track to whatever's on the radio right now is like this, because you're comparing something that's not finished, not engineered properly at that point, most likely, to something that's completely finished. So my trick to that, I say to my clients, that whatever reference you use, and say if you have it on your Pro Tools session or Logic session, whatever, put it down like at minus 15 or something, like make it really quiet. And then compare it to where you are, and try to have this vision that this room that you're building will have furniture in it. If you make the room too busy, where are you going to put the couch? And the couch is the most important thing, you know? So it takes some time to really be aware of these things. So that will be the first nugget of considering the three dimensionality, or I guess four dimensions of this whole thing, because time is a big one, you know?
Yeah, no, dude, that one was so big for me that it took me years as a producer, where I wanted it to sound big, like you said. So I'd put all these instruments, let me add more stuff, you know? And a lot of times I'd be working with my production partner, Nate, who plays keys, and he's like an amazing musician. Like, you know, I can like play around a little, but this dude's like incredible. So I'd just be like, add more, play more stuff. Let's get all these sounds. And it would sound big. And I'd be like, okay, I think it's starting to sound big. It's finally starting to sound big, but it's like, you know, it wasn't really doing what I wanted to do. And I realized, you know, an artist would listen to it and be like, well, where do I go? Where's the vote? Right. You know, it was like, there's no room. And then when we started stripping it way down, making a lot of space, that's when I really made a lot of progress as a producer, and started, you know, selling more beats, you know, getting more artists excited about it. Was, you know, like you said, it's kind of counterintuitive. It really is a lot of times less is more, and creating that space for the vocalist.
Yeah, totally. See, the thing is, audio is finite. We have 20 to 20,000 at the very best, which is never the case. So that is the range. We have left and right, so really two channels. And well, if you add the center, maybe that's like a third space, a virtual space. And that's really it. The only other variable that we can play with is time. So we can maybe use this riff or whatever here and another riff over there, you know, so that we can switch it up. But that's it. It's a finite space. So naturally, any Tetris player will know that you can't just generate space. You got to use what you got to make that line, right? It's the same thing with audio.
Yeah, no, totally, totally. I liked it. I think this is good for little quick tips for producers as far as mixing wise. What else? Maybe even as far as just kind of like a certain amount of mixing as they go. Or let's say this, assuming probably for most producers, depending on what stage they're at, you know, if they're selling beats online, they're mixing their own beats. And that's essentially going to be the mix of the beat. Anything plugin wise, specifics, big pictures, I don't know, any little tips you can think of that might be good for producers as far as mixing their own beats?
Again, this may be a not so sexy thing, but try to reduce the output volume of the beat, the actual RMS or LUFS, whatever it is. And again, to go back to the spacing leaving idea, right? If you're pushing everything up so loud that you're hitting, you know, the rough mix of the session that I'm mixing today and that I just loaded was at -5. That is like uber loud. And that's just the beat. So if we're adding a vocal, everything else needs to come down, right? So I would say, you know, try to favor a little more space. And maybe you can make a version for the person to stream on the website so that you can still have that impact. But when they go and get, you know, the actual track for them to record, maybe give them a unlimited version so that the transients are actually true and not cropped. And that would allow them to have more space. And of course, the other alternative would be to deliver the multi-tracks. But I do feel like that should have an extra cost because now you're having, you know, the client has a lot more opportunities and possibilities on doing things, you know. So that of course goes, you know, it's a producer choice, obviously. The other thing I would say is most likely the lead vocal will be in the center, at least for the verses, I would say. So maybe try to leave room in the middle and, you know, you use your bass, your kick drum, your snare or clap or something maybe in the middle because those only appear really quickly and go away. But maybe, you know, like a synth line or like a lead sound or whatever, try to put it in the stereo. So whether that's panning or using some sort of plugin to make it stereo artificially, like a flanger or a chorus or whatever the case, then that could help because now you're having a little more space for the vocal in the middle.
Nice. Yeah, that's huge. Another way to make that space like we were talking about. Cool. What about drums? Any quick tips for making those drums hit, making sure the kick actually is hitting the snare, the clap?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's arguably my favorite part of it. So drums all day.
It's the most important part.
Yeah. Right.
Man, you hear a beat come in, it has like a nice little intro, like, oh, okay, this synth sounds cool. All right. And then if those drums drop, it either makes it or it's like, okay, I'm turning it off.
Yeah. And the rule of thumb is that you can see if that's hitting by the amount of stinky face that you have on your face right. When it comes in, right? Exactly. You go like, ooh, like this, you know, it's hitting right.
Exactly.
Okay. So one thing I would say is try to, if we're talking about urban music, especially 808 based kind of stuff, I would say try to allocate a different piece of real estate for the kick drum than you have for the 808. So say the 808, assuming it's different notes, which usually it is, it will move around based on the note, obviously, right? But I guess a rule of thumb would be that the 808 usually, a healthy one, lives somewhere between 35, maybe at the deepest, to maybe like 60, 70, something like that. Of course, these numbers are just like a range, but you know, you have that pocket that usually is inhabited by the 808. So I would leave that area only for the 808. So in turn, the kick drum would sit above that. So say again, between 50, 60, something like that, to maybe like 150. So the effect is you got the hit of the kick drum, the attack of the kick drum that lives in an upper low end area, and the 808 is living at the lower part of the low end, right? So you have the activity, which happens often together, is actually being spread out on different regions of the frequency range. And that means that the woofer will be able to reproduce both almost at the same time with much more ease. And so the idea is that is going to give us more volume, more impact. And even though we reducing the low end output of the kick drum, which again, kind of counterintuitive. You're making the kick drum weaker on that area because you're making the bass stronger in that area. The two combined, they will sound huge.
Got it. Okay, that's what I was about to ask. So yeah, so making sure that they're not conflicting with each other by letting the 808 take those low lows and then the kick right above it. I was going to ask, so are you actually carving out some EQ on the bottom of that kick, or are you more just like saying select a kick, the sound selection in the first place, that's not hitting in those low parts? Are you a lot of times actually taking some of those low lows off the kick?
I will roll off the low end. So use a high pass to kill anything that's under, say, 40 hertz or whatever. But since we're talking to producers, the best way is always to choose the sound that's right for the dish that we're going for. Sure. So if you're at a place where you are selecting your kick drum and you already know that the chords of the beat will support a bass that's at 50 hertz or whatever, then maybe look into getting a kick drum that lives predominantly around 80 or something like that, right? So if you choose the right kick to begin with, that's even better. It's always better to have better ingredients. You know, everything will kind of unfold after that. So yeah, definitely select it. And then of course the EQ, the filtering will happen regardless after. But if we're relying on the first decision, then all the other decisions are going to be best later down the line, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. I love that. That's huge. And that was for me, the biggest thing is like, as a, you know, let's say producer/engineer, when people would say, hey, your mixes sound really good, most of the time, you know, and they say, well, like, what do you do? I'd be like, I'm not really a great engineer. I'm not Irko. I don't really, you know, I'm not a real engineer, but I just select good sounds, really, mostly. And then it's like, oh, this mix sounds amazing. It's like, well, just pick the right sounds in the first place. And like you said, it's start with the early stages, make it sound good from the start. And then there's a lot less to do later, you know, with the mixing and stuff.
Totally. Yeah. And you can even see it in very prolific producers' catalog over the years. Say, I don't know, Dre, for example, right? His production spans, what, 3 decades at this point? If you go and listen to the kick drums, for example, since we're talking about it, in, you know, the early 90s or even before that, it was a certain kind of sound, and you can tell it wasn't as powerful as what came 10 years later, and then 10 years later even further. It's like it's maximizing, right? And you develop the taste and what you develop also your know-how, right? And mm-hmm. It's similar to like Formula One cars or whatever. If you look at them 10 years ago, they look very different and they perform very differently, right? So it's the same thing with production.
That's interesting. Is there any like themes as far as mixing and stuff that you've seen, like, or trends from when you started till now, things that have stayed the same or things that have changed?
I would say that over the years, so say between like the difference between 80s and 90s and 90s and 2000 is the extreme of bands, of course, got bigger and bigger. First with vinyl or tape or something like that, you didn't have, you know, that deep low end and those super high frequencies, right? So the spectrum was a little narrow. Then we went to CDs where the spectrum was basically infinite, and so stuff got a lot taller and deeper, you know, in the frequency range. And the same could be said about the stereo field and the spatial effects, right? Then when MP3s came, of course, the hot, super high end kind of got cropped down because now, of course, in order to stream and compress the audio, we're losing all of that super high end, you know. But as a, you know, part of that, I guess the other side of that is that the harmonic content and the loudness came substantially more in the last 2 decades or whatever, right? So louder is always better for the ear because it feels more immersive. It's also, you know, just by a biology standpoint, the louder feels more impressive, right? But on the other hand of that, since we are controlling it, we can control the loudness, we should definitely pay a lot of attention to that, because even though it's true that the louder the better, there is like a sweet spot after which you're getting to degrade the sound, and so you gotta know and be mindful of that fine balance between the loudness and the removal of the transients, you know. And that kind of leads to the harmonic content that's you know, we kind of had it going on in the 70s or whatever because everything was recorded to tape, so harmonics were left and right everywhere. And then we kind of lost all of that when the audio went digital. And now that we have these incredible tools that allow us to play around and be very creative with all of that, it kind of came back. So I use harmonic content all the time on everything, basically.
Nice, nice. Cool. So switching gears a little bit, obviously you're incredible, you know, engineer, you're amazing at your craft. You've been working on this. But also there's part of it is the branding and the marketing, you know, business side of it. You know, one thing is you're always wearing a bow tie. I'm curious, you know, where that came from and, you know, how do you think about your branding and how does that play into your success?
Yeah, I feel like because music is communication, communicating what you're about, if you are in the music, is very, very important because there's so many other people that are doing something similar, but yet you're very unique because you are one and there's no one else, right? Just like you. And so that was my thinking when I started to kind of put myself out a little more, be in front of cameras for videos and my YouTube and stuff like that. I was like, I want to make sure that I present myself as I am. So, you know, instead of kind of like try to be very in this box that somebody or like the industry kind of created for audio engineers, I was like, you know what? I'm going to just be me. I'm the quirky Italian guy that wears bow ties, that works for rappers. And that's what I'm going for. And I'm selling my Italianism big time. Hence the bow ties and all of these other things, you know. By the way, this is made of concrete, just so you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. And so basically, to me, communication, you know, there's nothing like sleazy or car salesman kind of technique of communicating what you're about. It's really about making the world know what I do, in my case, is mixing. And, you know, my looks and kind of how I handle things, which is kind of fun, but at the same time, I know what I'm doing. I've been doing it for so long that there's, you know, don't take me as like a meme. Like, yeah, I'll be the funny guy for sure, but you know, I know my shit. And right. And so that's kind of how I based my whole communication in terms of letting the world know what I'm about. And yeah, bow tie started because I used to wear regular ties, but then I bought my first GoPro and I wanted to film me working on console. And obviously if I strapped it on my chest, it wouldn't work with the regular tie. So I went for the bow tie and it's been like that since.
And now I have almost 300.
Yes.
Nice. Man, gems on gems. What about for you, like personally, do you have a routine? Do you have a mindset? Do you have a practice? Is there something that kind of keeps you focused and motivated? You know, whether if it's, I don't know, exercise, meditation, morning routine, any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, pre-COVID, I used to go and work out every morning before my sessions. Now, since then, I haven't done that. And I really hate it, actually, because that was my hour off the top of the day that I would listen to music. I would get inspired by listening to what was on the charts and stuff like that. And I totally missed that. I can't wait to go back to that. Like the actual parks here in LA got shut down. So there's, you know, if I want to work out, gyms, of course, are closed. And so if I wanted to work out, I had to do it at home, which kind of tried, but it's not really my thing, but whatever. But yeah, morning routine for sure. And then my days are also kind of split between different sections. So for example, in the beginning of the day, I always do revisions that have been asked by my clients the day before or something like that. So I like to get those out so they have the actual day to sit and live with the mixes. And at any given time, I may have 10, 15 mixes open. So this could actually take some time. Some days it's a little bit it's time consuming. But then after that, I dig deep into the mixes of the day. I usually do about I work on two songs in one day. So like the first chunk of the day, say 3-4 hours or something like that, I will dedicate to the beginning stages of the mix of song one. And then the afternoon or the next 3-4 hours, I will dedicate to the second half of the mix that I started the day before. So I like to split these two because in the first sitting, I take care of all the nerdy numbers, audio engineer nerd kind of things like filtering, compression and things like that. And the second half I dedicate to the communication of what the mix is saying. So that's where I put the audio engineering interaction together with the message of the song and the intent of the beat. So automations, movements, things like that, you know, checking on the levels of everything, stuff like that, right? And that usually the second part of the session. And then the last day, I mean, the last task of the day is to prep the sessions that are upcoming in the next couple of days. And so that's when I prepare everything. You know, my clients are sending in files that are coming from any DAW, any computer that you can imagine. So there's a lot of, okay, what is this? What's going on? Where's the kick drum kind of thing? You know, all of that, like familiarize myself with the tracks. And then other than that, you know, that's pretty much my routine. It will change sometimes depending if I have crazy deadlines or an album flow of work is different than a single song kind of workflow. But for the most part, that's kind of how I do it. And
Nice. No, it's huge. I think that's such a big gem is that concept of chunking, where it's like you're doing chunks of time of specific tasks. People, I think, really underestimate how much time and energy it takes to switch gears. You know what I mean? Where you go from doing whatever, I don't know, answering emails to doing this next thing. Every time you jump around, every time you skip around, your brain just takes a little while to get into that new groove. And I know for me, it's something I'm always working on because I can be a little bit, you know, jumping from here to here and here's the next shiny object. Always way more productive if I can be like, okay, for the next however many hours, this is the thing that I'm focusing on. I'm just going to do this type of task or this specific task. So I think that's a huge productivity hack right there. Just chunk things together, stick with this one thing and then switch this other thing as opposed to switching around back and forth between like three or four things.
Right. Which can be difficult when you have so many projects open at once, you know, so, and you, you got people from all different time zones hitting you up and stuff. It gets complicated sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. I think it takes a certain type of discipline for sure to not get distracted. And also, especially, I think when you're working with people the way that you are, you know, having sort of like boundaries and structure around that communication, I think is really important. Where I know, you know, I'll just speak for myself, like making sure that I do as good a job as I can of communicating, because if all of a sudden somebody doesn't hear from me for a few days and, you know, for example, I'm doing their mix, that's something that's very important to them, they're going to be upset. But then also having some boundaries around, well, your emergency is not necessarily my emergency. You know what I mean? Like, hey, this is the deadline we agreed on, or this is the timeline that we're working on. I don't have time to answer your text or email or whatever right now at this moment. I will get back to you, you know, in a reasonable, whatever, less than 24 hours, whatever it is. But I think having some of those boundaries is also important. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how what your experience with that has been, but it can be definitely working directly with clients. I find that you really have to be clear with that type of stuff.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. I tend to run my business as regular business hours. So, you know, early morning or mid morning, whatever, to maybe like late afternoon. But I, you know, if you're calling me at 11 p.m. about a revision, it's like, I just, you know, let's talk tomorrow when I'm in front of Pro Tools kind of thing, you know?
Right. Man, well, I think we've covered a lot. Maybe we can just, you know, start to wrap it up here soon. A couple things before we get out of here is you know, what are the things that you're excited about working on moving forward? Where people can find you and anything else you want to wrap it up with?
Extremely excited about this new build out that I've been working on for the past almost 4 years, I guess, is that I'm building from the ground up a new recording studio complex with two recording studios and two apartments here in LA. And I've been documenting the whole thing from literally before the groundbreaking. And you can see episodes and updates on the construction of this new studio every week on my YouTube. Just put Irko on YouTube, it'll pop right up. There's nobody named that anywhere. And so very excited about that. At this point, the outside shell of the studio, so the actual building exists, it's fully finished. And we're getting ready to move in to do the interior with the floating room, you know, all the fabric walls and all of that stuff. So it's very fascinating. So if you like any kind of recording studio related activities, seeing it grow literally from dirt, from a hole in the ground, it's very fascinating. So definitely go check that out. Every week I have a new episode. So it's really interesting. Other than that, you can find me on all media, Irko Studio Beat. That's everywhere. And I post pretty much regularly. And yeah, definitely keep in touch with me.
Irko, appreciate it, man.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Thank you for listening to the MIDI Money Podcast. If you're not subscribed already, please be sure to do that right now on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you do me a quick favor and rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or comment and like the videos on YouTube. You know, those ratings, reviews, those comments, they all show that people are getting value, helps the algorithm, and helps get this podcast out to more producers. So it means so much to me if you'd be willing to take a couple minutes to do that. Oh, and if you'd like to learn more about how I was able to turn Legion Beats into a profitable business and how you can join our community of hundreds of producers all working towards that same goal, head over to midimoney.com/go.